you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The Incomparable, number 604, March 2022.
Welcome back to The Incomparable. I'm Tiff Arment, your guest host this week for an episode of Video Game Club, and we are here to talk about Little Nightmares 2, a creepy hide-and-seek puzzle platformer. Joining me on this dark and rainy journey are two companions wearing upsetting hats. First, let me welcome Brian Hamilton. Hello, Brian.
Hi, if I reach through the computer screen at just the right time, do you think I could just zoom over to where y'all are hanging out?
That would be awesome. I really wish that were possible. Also joining us is James Thompson. Hello, James.
Hello. I'm just going to kill all these children with pipes in a totally not upsetting manner.
Your intro is so much darker than Brian's. Right in line with this game.
I'm going to hang out with my friends. Let's kill everyone.
So I would like to preface with this game is a prequel to the first Little Nightmares, which the three of us discussed on episode 7 of Recently Played. But you don't need to have played the first one in order to enjoy this game. You may miss some nods and some reveals might not be as potent. So a little background, Little Nightmares 2 was released February 2021, 4 years after its predecessor Little Nightmares, and it can be played on almost all modern platforms. The story, which predates the events of the first game, follows Mono, our bag-faced protagonist, who must work together with Six, the protagonist from the previous game, to survive the horrors of the Pale City and discover its dark secrets. Okay, let's start off the spoiler horn so we can get into this completely unfeathered. So, you two, we played the first one together. Well, not together, but we played the first one. Now we played the second one. And I think we all kind of agree the second one is way better.
So much better. Way scarier, too.
I think what we said about the first one was we really liked everything about it, apart from possibly the gameplay, which was... There were certainly bits of it where you were fighting the controls more than you were fighting the things that were after you. And this one, it comes together a lot better. I think I have also come to the conclusion that I do not like being chased as a thing, which is kind of the entirety of this game. But I really enjoyed this one.
I feel like when it comes to... the controls and the chase sequences both are tightened up so much more in this game to the point where right when I started and you are outside, running through the forest, I thought, oh, this makes more sense. It controls way better. It feels way better. Of course, this was a post-Inside by Playdead game, so it totally makes sense. Then I thought, wait a second. The first Little Nightmares game is also a post-Inside game. Oh, they just really tighten things up for the second game.
Yeah, I mean, in general... For me, this game was a lot more fun because things were tighter. You can interact with a lot more stuff. There was like a little bit of combat, which is nice. Overall, I do have some things I don't like about this game, but I think that they're like minor technical things as opposed to the overall ambiance of it. I love the style of game. I felt very strong Inside Limbo vibes, like off, like as soon as the game even opens up, you're in the woods, right? Like it's
Yeah, exactly. I was right playing away. That and I was thinking, yeah, this seems vaguely familiar with all the just solving these little puzzles. Like, have I played this before?
So if you like that kind of game, this is just like another chance to live in that world for a few hours. And it's not very long. And I think that that is right for this type of game. It's like, I can't sustain that level of tension for like a 40-hour game, but I can for like a 6 to 12-hour game, depending on how thorough you get.
I did not get thorough.
There's not much to be thorough about in this game. In the first one, you have the gnomes to collect. In this one, there's like some spirit children things, which might unlock an alternate ending that I haven't found. But it felt like there was way less to discover in this game than the first game, which I didn't really mind.
It did indeed unlock a sort of secret ending, but it's, you know, just like 10-second thing.
Yeah, it's totally not worth unlocking. It's worth going and finding someone else who unlocked it and watching them unlock it. But we'll get into that. We'll get into like the nitty gritty and we'll talk about all the pieces of this game. First, I want to kind of talk a little bit about the plot, where this game's coming from. And so where we start this game, you are basically rescuing the character Six, who, like I said earlier, is the protagonist from the previous game. And the two of you travel on a door raft to a decrepit city. And then together they navigate the crumbling terrain and they go through buildings. And throughout their escape, Mono, who you were playing as, continues to try and use like old televisions to access this dream universe where he sees visions of a hallway and a door with an eye above it. So this is very much like a creepy little horror game. And what I love about this is that in this kind of realm of games, which seem to be becoming its own genre, where you don't have any cutscenes, you don't have any dialogue, you don't even know the names of these characters besides like looking them up online. And yet you get such a deep story that really moves you along emotionally and like attaches you to these tiny little silent characters. And I absolutely love the style of this. And even though the plot isn't a plot, like you're not, you know, follow, you still get so attached and you want these characters to succeed. You want them to win. You want them to survive. And yet you know so little about them. And I love that it throws that right off the bat.
I think one of the things that I enjoy in this is the fact that you've got a companion with you running around the levels with you, because I don't know, but for me, it made the sort of horror of it slightly less. You know, it was easier to deal with because you weren't the only person in the room dealing with it, which is weird because they're not real, but you kind of know what I mean. So they do the whole eco thing where, you know, you have a companion who helps you up things and gives you boosts so you can reach platforms and stuff. And of course they do it also so that you get used to it, and then she goes away for bits of the game. And it's that taking it away thing, and it's like, oh, now I really am on my own.
Having the companion make it quote-unquote less scary means the game can go way scarier because it feels less scary. And Little Nightmares 2 is genuinely terrifying in a bunch of ways that I think the first Little Nightmares was, you know, a little bit more creepy. I mentioned Tim Burton on the last episode. This one is like, I had legit nightmares for a few days after playing this.
See, you told me it was going to be scary, so I was expecting it to be really, really scary. And yes, there are a lot of creepy elements, but I don't think I was any more scared than the first one. I mean, the first one has that like awful clown in the water, which is terrible. There wasn't, I think I just kept expecting, as you were moving through this landscape and going into these buildings, that like you would encounter something really disgusting and terrifying. Like I found like the chefs and stuff in the first one to be very like disgusting. They made them so vomitous, right? And this one, you had the like big giant enemies, but none of them were really disgusting. They were strange. Like we have you know, Beetlejuice teacher, but like there, but it wasn't as much. And I don't think there were that many large enemies as in the first one. It was more a lot of these smaller foes that you came across, like the porcelain children in the school and the severed hands in the hospital. But yeah, and I also agree with James about having the companion. I love the elements of being able to like whisper and hold hands. It created this element of connection that you did feel like you had someone to like ground you, right? In this whole, like, I'm moving through this, but I'm not alone. And maybe that also, like Brian said, helped with the creep factor in that you weren't feeling so isolated.
I think the other thing that kind of brought it down a little bit, in terms of the level of terror, is at the end of the first chapter, you just straight out shotgun someone to death. And it's like, oh, so we've got some more agency in this one to actually like fight back.
Yes.
Because in the first one, there was very little kind of that you could do. And in this, you go around and you're picking up sort of makeshift weapons and various things as you go along. So it's kind of less, I mean, yes, you're being pursued by supernatural things, but they're more physical. So you can do something about it.
The little in Little Nightmares for the first game really implied a sense of like, you are small, the adults can squish you. Whereas in this game, I feel like the little in Little Nightmares manifests itself more in the level design where you are climbing up, you know, cabinets and bookshelves and things. And you did that in the first game too, but there are way less, you know, giant characters that make you feel like you're going to be squished. It's more that you're going to be eaten by Beetlejuice teacher. We've said twice so far, we can't say it again.
A long neck teacher. Oh, she is quite scary. There was a lot more moments of having like these close-ups of the enemies, whereas I feel like in the first game, we're going to be doing a lot of comparisons because, I mean, how could you not? But I really do feel that this game could stand on its own. Like if you didn't play the first one, you would still be plenty happy playing through this one. But they had a lot more close-ups of these enemies and there was a lot more light brought onto them. And I feel like you got a lot of kind of like looking into the camera texture scares, you know, from these enemies. And maybe it's because there were fewer of them. They really wanted to highlight them for you. I'm not sure. Maybe it was also that the character you're playing of Mono is much more obviously a boy, little like a little child, whereas the first game you weren't quite sure if they looked humanoid, but you also had the gnomes, so you're like, what are you playing as? But this one you were definitely sure there were like two children. But yeah, the scares in this, there was a lot more meaty bits around too, like there was a lot more background gore, I guess, than in the first one. And it also makes me think of like, so I have a 10-year-old who likes creepy things. Well, he's almost 10, but like he likes creepy things in games. And as a parent who also likes creepy things in games, I don't really know where that line falls of, can I show this to a kid to play this, you know, or like, can we play it together? Or is it too much? Because
I think we answered this because Brian was having nightmares. So
right.
I am a wuss, I will say.
I mean, I didn't have any nightmares from this one, but I mean, if Brian was having nightmares, I mean, I don't want to make my kid have nightmares. I mean, it's in the name of the game. Little nightmares.
There's a difference between like getting your kid to think and process things in a different way through horror and traumatizing them, which is what happened with me when I saw way too young.
Oh my God.
And because I'm me and I'm contractually obligated to mention Hereditary and Midsommar, you mentioned the difference between light and more detail versus the shadows of the first game. And this game definitely does show a lot more things with less obscurity and shadow, save for the hospital level, in the same way that Ari Aster's 2019 film Midsommar is all about sunlight. It's in Sweden. It's still a terrifying, scary horror movie because you can still see everything and all the gory details. No pun intended.
Also, when this game came out, they only had PS4 and like Xbox One versions of them. And quite a few months later, I think it was like 6 months later, and it was after I'd played through the game, they brought out PlayStation 5 and Series X ones, and they look really nice. You know, there's kind of ray tracing and fog, and apparently there's like 3D, better 3D sound and stuff. I was really annoyed because I went back to the PlayStation 5 version and it was like, yeah, you're going to start this game from the beginning again. Because the PlayStation has had a problem with importing saves from PS4 games, and they only just like added an API for developers recently. So I think these games, there was lots of things where you had to like, or where you go to download the PS4 version, upload to this cloud, then you can go and download your save again. Anyway, but yeah, the PlayStation 5 one, I played a bit of that today and went through the first level again, and it looks really nice.
So talking about playing on different platforms, I played the first game on Switch, and I was very upset because there were no achievements. And yeah. I love getting my achievements, right? Like, I like, you know, being rewarded. You're a good gamer girl. Here, you did something weird, and you can see the percentage of the other people who did this weird thing, and, you know, you feel special about it. And so this time I played on the PlayStation. I only have a PlayStation 4. I don't have a 5 yet, but it looked pretty great to me, and I was very pleased that there are a number of achievements out there. So the things that you can collect in this game, Brian mentioned there's kind of like these little glitchy people that you, through the end of the game, you kind of figure out like why they're there and where they came from, but you can like find them in little crevices. And if you collect all of the glitches, you get the alternate ending or an extra scene at the end, which is definitely not worth it. Like, it's like 15 seconds. But if you're a completionist, definitely go do it. We will talk about what that alternate ending is. It's not really an alternate, I guess it's just an addition ending. And also another collectible in this game are hats. You can find hats throughout all the levels, and I believe there's 12 of them. I found 6. And I want to go back and find them all. And then in addition to that, if you're not playing on Switch, there are the achievements of like, you did something weird, like, oh, you opened up this refrigerator, and, you know, it gives you an achievement for opening a refrigerator. So those are out there too. And they're also fun to get, but they're not collectibles. So you're not quite sure where they are or what's going to give you an achievement. So this game actually took me a long time to play because I was touching everything, like anything, like even from the very first scene in the beginning of this game where you show up in a field next to an old television set that's kind of like on a static channel, and there's a block, and I carried that block as far as I possibly could. I was like, this block is here. I can pick it up and I'm carrying it. And actually it helped me out because a few more steps down into the forest, there's an area where it looks kind of suspicious that there's something hanging over you or some sort of, the leaves look different. So I took the block, I threw it into the leaves and it sprung a trap, and I'm like, sweet. I carried this sucker for a reason. But there are a lot of those like kind of gameplay things out there for this game, depending on what platformer you play it on. And I guess tying it in, I kind of want to talk about the controls also. I was going to put this in my complaints section, but since we're talking about different consoles and different ways to play, Brian, what did you play this on?
I played Little Nightmares 1 and 2 on Switch. I know last time I complained about the load times on Switch. Little Nightmares 2 looks way better and loaded infinitely faster, and I don't know how they pulled it off. For this replay, I wanted to play it on PS5, but wound up not, because it does sound like it looks amazing, and I didn't realize there was a specific bespoke PS5 version out there, so I'm really excited to try that at some point. This game's also perpetually on sale, by the way, on all the platforms, so if you, like me, want to get it on a second platform just to have it, you know, look better, that should be something that is more feasible in, like, a week or two. It's on sale perpetually. But yeah, I really did enjoy how much faster it went and how much better it looked on the Switch.
But you don't have the achievements on the Switch, correct?
I'm not an achievement boy.
That's fine. Yeah. You don't have to be. And so the controls for me on the PlayStation, does the PlayStation 5 have a different controller, James, than the PlayStation 4?
Yes, it does. It's mostly the same layout, but it's kind of, the triggers are better. It's quite heavy. I like the controller, but I've spent the last 100-odd hours playing through all the Mass Effect games again, and I'm doing that on the Xbox Series X. So I've been using that controller a lot, and I'm finding that lighter in my hands, at least. The PlayStation 5 one is kind of a hefty beast. You could definitely bash in the head of a small porcelain child with one.
So I found I was getting a lot of hand cramps with this game, and I was reading a little bit about it, and there was another criticism about how like some of the movements and the controls that are required to like get through this game were causing some cramping. And I wonder if it's because I was using the PlayStation 4 controller, but I was finding that some of the gameplay when it came to navigating both like around a corner and you're trying to like either smash or use a flashlight and like doing a couple like combination jumps and grabs, I found my fingers getting all like cramped up because I was forcing it so much on the controllers. And I'm not sure if that is just like I'm a very tense, grabby player, or it was just the way that the controller was mapped to start off for this game.
I think like the fact that it's got like the grabs and stuff on the triggers, that probably is an element of that. I don't think the combat isn't very precise, I think, regardless of what platform you play it on. It's a kind of very loose, floaty, you're like, you know, you've got a pipe or an axe or whatever it is. And it, you know, you kind of like just throw it in the rough direction and then it takes a couple of seconds to get it back again. And I don't think it's supposed to be, you know, that kind of, you're a small child wielding weapons, and it feels like that.
Yeah, like the lumbering part that the player is experiencing, is that intentional because of the character, like you said, the character is like trying to use this pipe that's three times the size of them. So like, it's going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult to like climb up something. Like I felt like the movements and the combat were difficult with the way everything was on the controller. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I guess you could look at it in the way of this is like it kind of translated to the type of character that you're playing. But at the same time, I was not thrilled that I came away from playing this game, like sitting for, you know, a few hours and playing it. And like my fingers kind of like stuck in a little crook.
Because, like, yeah, that's not like, good.
It stinks. But it didn't take away from my gameplay enjoyment of it. I was just disappointed that like I felt like I was, you know, getting the claw, you know, the gamer claw from playing this game.
It felt very intentionally designed to be sluggish in a way that reminded me a lot of Fall Guys, oddly enough, where the sluggishness of the controls and when you push the A button, you have to take, you know, a few seconds to wield your axe and then throw it and then whatever. It felt like it gave you this extra sense of I don't have enough agency in this world to move myself through as fast as I want, in the same way like when you're in a real life nightmare and you're running from the wolf or whatever and you can't run fast enough. I thought that was a really great way to add tension to it, especially to your point, Tiff, the chase sequences. I loved those sequences because they are perfectly timed so that if you just lean the controller all the way to the right and just keep running, you're going to make it by the skin of your teeth, even if it feels like you're about to be, you know, killed the entire time. That's what gives me the thrills in this game.
I think there was a few of those chases where I kept messing it up and then I was just fed up with them. You know, once you've repeated something more than like once or twice, I think the tension goes, or at least the horror part of it goes, and you're just annoyed. There's something about that mechanic in games when you're being chased that I don't like. This did it reasonably well, but I mean, even like in the first level where you're being pursued by the hunter guy, I was like, I wasn't quite sure what I was supposed to be doing, and he just kept shooting me.
That was one of my biggest criticisms of this, is that there are certain games that as you play, you can feel like you said, Brian, you can feel like you're running through it and you get by it, the skin of your teeth. And that's where like the thrill comes from. And I think this game has this so often. But for people that fail like me and do things over and over and over again, just like James said, it takes a lot of that away. Like it takes the adrenaline out of it and it just becomes a slog. And I almost think that they missed a little bit of the balance here when it came to player agency through some of those like chase scenes and critical moments, where I feel like there are certain points where they should have not let me fail. You know, like I should have had the agency of like being able to run and feel like, yes, I did this, and like maybe make like that one final slide like under the door or something, like great. But if as I'm running and I like accidentally like shoulder clip a little edge of the wall and that makes me fail and I have to do it all over again, it's like, don't put that there. Like, let me run and feel the adrenaline of something chasing me. But then as soon as like one little mess up, like you can't quite see the path right, it just, it takes all the air out of it. And I was kind of disappointed with a lot of that because I'm a person that I like difficult games, but sometimes maybe it was kind of like I'm playing with, you know, the finger claw. I'm all like cramped up. But if I don't get something right, I'll keep doing it. And that's fine with me. But in a thrilling game like this, where it's a lot of those chase scenes and a lot of the adrenaline, I was getting mad that I kind of like missed the emotional checkpoints here because I had to keep redoing something. And that especially for me happened at the very end. The very end! I missed the final jump. And I guess we already did the spoiler horn so we can like talk about this. But there is a moment at the very, very end of this game where you are making like this final jump away from this like horrible blob that's following you very inside. But you're supposed to be caught by your partner. I trip and fall off the world and have to do it again two more times.
I had similar experiences, especially with that last big sequence. I did that so many times, and that's why that I think these things don't work, because I mean, it's good, but you want to be able to kind of have the thing that's chasing you hang back a little bit if you're kind of doing, if you're a bit slow. And
no, I want them to like put in like a fail safe, you know, like where it's like the developers know that like, okay, if you miss this, the emotional part of it is more important than the gameplay here.
Yeah.
Right. So they like keep you going. I felt like Inside did that really well, where like you're running from the blob at the end of Inside. Sorry, spoilers, people who have not played Inside, get it together and go play that game. You are running from that another blob, and yet you feel so stressed and you're running the whole time. And I don't feel like that there was a lot of fail points in those runs. Whereas here in this game, they give you so many fail points that like missing that final emotional, you know, crescendo of grabbing her hand was like, I felt so cheated. I'm like, I played this whole game for this moment and I messed it up. I'm mad at myself. But at the same time, I'm also mad at the developers for letting me fail. How dare they?
To be fair, she just drops you immediately afterwards. So
I know, but that's like part of it. Like, I want that, like the, like, you know, the success of like grabbing the hand and then the, oh no, you're looking at me. You're looking at my hand. Don't, you're hesitating. Why are you, don't let go. Holy crap, you let go. Like, I want all that to be there. And I love that this game has that. And yet it let me miss that. Like,
Celeste is another game that I think of as a very difficult game that's very generous to the player in all of those ways. They're like, if you are like a pixel off, it's okay, we'll let you go. Portal 2 is another game I know that has a bit of a code override for a critical moment where you have to fire a portal, and like 50% of players got which portal it was wrong. So the developer said, look, we'll just let you do this with either portal that you fire. And I think that works extremely well. The counterpoint, Tiff, to your tension being ruined by having to try over and over again, I hope they don't mind that I'm telling a story. Truge played Inside for the first time maybe a year or two ago and kept dying over and over at the very beginning and said, I don't want to play this anymore. These gruesome animations of a little kid being killed are ruining the game for me. I was like, what are you talking about? There's not many of that. Oh, it's because I didn't die very much and you died a lot. And that experience of people experiencing games differently, I think, is like one of the reasons I play video games, because it's so much fun to see how everyone else did something or accomplished something or reacted to an emotional moment when Six drops you. I thought that final moment was not, it didn't land as much for me because you die a million times in the game previously and you just reboot. It's like, oh, I'll just reboot. Oh, I don't. That is the like difficult part of the end of this game.
Yeah, I mean, we can get into the plot and things later, but I was going to say, I think one of the criticisms we had of the first game was that the checkpointing wasn't particularly great. Like, you would do quite a long sequence, then mess it up, and you would have to redo the whole thing. This, I thought, was better. But still, if I have to repeat something more than twice, you know, you can all say it's because I'm bad at games or whatever, but I just don't like that experience.
This is not the game where you have to be an esports athlete in order to get the emotional parts of the game. And I wish the developers had weighed more on the side of get the emotional impact over that finish line rather than make this jump perfectly or else you fail.
Yeah, yeah. I don't mind redoing like combat sequences a bunch of times in order to get through them, because I feel like that's more of like grinding, right? Like, you need to get rid of all these enemies and then get through this level. Like, fine. There's no real, you know, emotional checkpoints at stake there. But something like a chase scene or a final jump or something, just let it happen, you know. And I think that's very much the developer having more emotional connection with the players in the game as opposed to like making gameplay. And I'm not like, you know, pointing fingers here, but for me, that separates a immaculate game from like a really great game. And I love this game so much. I love the characters. I love the setting. I love the art style. I love, you know, the way that things are highlighted in this game. I love the, like, the paths are like slightly highlighted. I love this, the scratch marks in the ground when you need to move a crate. I like the little worn edges on bookshelves, like how this game beautifully leads you through a world. But I just feel like that this particular one, I wish that's where they missed the mark here, was having those chase scenes be a little bit more weighted on the emotional side as opposed to the gameplay.
I remember when we were playing the first one, I think I said that I thought the DLC where you're running around collecting gnomes, mm-hmm. I thought that was my favorite bit of that first game, and they got better at doing stuff as time went on. And I thought the puzzles also in this were good. You know, there was quite a few that I like, that sense of feeling clever because you figured this out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I come to these games for, I guess, as well. It's just, you know, you have to run away from things as part of the process. But we should probably talk about the levels, you know, just generally what the chapters are and what the kind of who you encounter and things. So, I mean, yeah, the first one, as we said, chapter one, it's mostly the kind of tutorial at the start. And then you rescue Six, who's locked away by this hunter, or is locked away in some other cabin. I can't actually remember if it's the same cabin.
Yeah, yeah, it's the hunter's cabin.
And then, you know, you've got to get away. And I think it's Six that holds up the shotgun in a kind of like encouraging you to shoot this guy way.
Yeah, she takes aim and then you have to like pull the trigger, like help her, because the shotgun is so much bigger than the two of you. It's the size of the hunter, it's not the size of these characters. So I think that's the first moment in the game where they indicate, hey, together you might be able to wield some larger weapons against a lot of these enemies you're going to be encountering.
I also think it gives an indication that perhaps Six is not the nicest of little children.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
If you like a good murder mystery story, you'll love June's Journey, a free hidden object mobile game where Detective June Parker unravels the mystery of her sister's death. Travel back to the beautifully illustrated 20s, find clues, discover hidden objects, and watch the story unfold with new chapters released weekly. Put your detective skills to the test. Download June's Journey on Android or iOS, or play online via Facebook Games.
So yeah, so let's go through each chapter. So as you said, chapter one, you start off in the woods and you meet the hunter, who then you dispense of pretty quickly after you find Six. And then you both travel across the water on a door raft and you get to the city. Chapter two takes you, where does chapter two take us?
That's the orphanage.
The orphanage and the... I seem to completely be focusing on the children, the little porcelain children, because I find that so disturbing, the kind of like, because you hit them in the heads with whatever weapons are around and it smashes their heads in. And yeah, chapter two is also where we meet a delightful long-necked teacher who follows you into the pipes and things.
I like to imagine that she's like an eldritch horror creature thing, like half snake or something that just stole the body of a woman and is doing terrible things to the skin. Oh my God, it's my favorite thing in the whole game.
You hate it and love it at the same time.
An eldritch horror that decided what they really wanted to do was to go into teaching.
The salary is not great, but it's just a passion.
Yeah, I mean, it's... in that chapter... the person that you rescued finds her yellow jacket that she's wearing in the first game. And that was, I think, the point where you go, oh, right, this is actually Six. So this does connect in directly because they don't explicitly say it.
Did you know that before that moment? Because that was the reveal for me.
I didn't know it. But, you know, it didn't surprise me, I guess.
I kind of guessed through the iconography because I like a lot of the saves in the beginning, like they have the little bag boy shape and then they have the, you know, rain slicker shape of Six. And so like the two of them together, that kind of made me think like, okay, this little girl that I'm picking up is probably Six. But I forgot it was a prequel for a little bit. And I was like, oh, what's going on here? Like I was all into the story and then I'm like, oh, yeah, it's happening before here. But yeah, I think it's pretty cool that they connect it in that way, but it's not absolutely necessary. And a lot of the iconography, like throughout the even the in the wilderness, like you find the little blocks and they have the eye on it. And there is graffiti around a lot of the levels of gnomes, like they're on stickers of shipping boxes. Did you notice that? Like the shipping boxes have like a little gnome label, the eye is everywhere. There is also this graffiti of this dog peeing on things. Did you notice that, like all over the place? I'm pretty sure it was like indicating where there might be a hat or something, because a lot of the times if you like look around the area where the dog peeing graffiti was, you could find a hidden secret or a collectible. Amazing. That was around. Did you see those?
I didn't know. Maybe because you're a dog owner that this called out to you more.
I just thought it was so funny that there's like this like little kid art of this dog and it's peeing. And like, because kids always like find things like that fascinating. Like, oh, I made a dog pee. Like, they think they're being so bad.
The other thing that I loved about the orphanage school sequence, one of the top three sequences in the whole game for me, is you learn how dangerous those porcelain children are, and you escalate and escalate and escalate. You learn you can smash them, you can kill them. There's a bit of a combat scene. And then once you find the head and put it on, you are brought into a room with like 50 of them, and you have to navigate your way through a... like several rooms where all of these kids are around. And if they discover you are not a porcelain kid, they're going to freaking kill you. And I thought that was a perfect example of the way that horror can escalate and grow and creep you out, which is done, again, very well in the hospital scene where there's a trillion freaky mannequins, which we'll pivot to in a second.
So our number two is the orphanage. There were a number of puzzles and things in the orphanage. Anything that stood out to you that you might... Was the chess puzzle here? I believe it was.
Yes.
I like that puzzle. I thought that was fun. I also like how a lot of the puzzles that you come across, there is kind of like an answer key if you're a very... you know, finder person, if you're like looking under everything, moving, like trying to interact with anything that you could possibly interact with. Sometimes the answers are just like, you know, behind a drawing that you could pull off the wall or something like that. Yeah. And or you can try and figure it out on your own, which I really like that they give you those two avenues for two different types of players.
Yeah, definitely. I think with that chess one, it was one of the ones that it was up on the wall. I think I found that.
I found that after I did I moved all the pieces around and I'm like, damn it. It was all right there.
It's just like Taskmaster, you know, where the answer is kind of sellotaped under a desk.
You never think to look.
I think, yeah, chapter 3 is the weird hospital, but there's a lot of running around finding fuses and stuff in that one that I remember. And I enjoyed the puzzles that were associated that with the, like, you know, I have to take this fuse out and then move it somewhere else and do something. And then that will give me another fuse. And then I've got two kind of, so I enjoyed that. And yeah, the third one, you've got the creepy, everything's prefaced by the word creepy, the creepy mannequins where you've got your torch that you can freeze them in place. And there's that bit where you're walking through and there's like dozens of them around and you're kind of just like whirling around in circles with the torch trying to stop them coming near you. I thought that was very effective.
Again, an escalation from one mannequin to maybe two to a room of 50.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I found that both with the orphanage and the hospital, there were these two sections that were basically like gauntlets that you had to run, where in the orphanage it was kind of like the locker gauntlet where you're running and all the porcelain children are kind of chasing you and you have to, you know, smash and run and dodge your way into rescuing Six, because at one point Six gets kind of like taken by these porcelain children. You need to rescue her, and there's various like things that happen that keeps pushing you forward to all these different locations. And then in the hospital, you have that whole gauntlet of like the hands that are reaching out from the areas. And then again, the mannequins. And those are the places where I didn't mind being tripped up by failing, because I felt like, yes, those are very scary moments, but it's also very difficult. And you kind of have to play them a few times to figure out like where you have to go, which ones you can kind of like dodge from, which ones you have to take out before you can get past them. And so like I didn't mind that at all. I liked those parts because those were like the two main big stressful combat situations. Mm-hmm. And I like a game that has a good like give and take of I'm playing sneaky hide and seek stealth games, and then I have to run and get through this and kind of like face this like fearful fight in front of me. And then I get like another area of like calm exploration that I get to like sneak around again. So, and I think that in this game, it gives both of those. And I really enjoy that.
It gives both of those styles, but it's not like a Breath of the Wild or Skyrim where you can choose puzzle to puzzle how you deal with it. It's like you're in a clearing, here's your axe, this is combat, and then you have nothing, there's a bunch of things, you just have to run and gun and stealth. It's kind of those divvied up sequences, which is not bad, but I can imagine like a D&D player coming to this and being like, I wish I could do this part of the game differently.
Yeah, I mean, like, this isn't a game where there's multiple solutions to anything, really. Chapter 3 also gives us the ceiling guy. I don't know what his real name
the
is.
The doctor.
The doctor.
Who you lure into a furnace and then burn. And Six warms her hands next
him.
To the burning guy. And it's like, yeah, she's not good.
I actually, you're not good in that scene, because I did a little reading. You could choose just to close the door and walk away.
Oh,
like,
well,
you did not have to turn on the fire and burn that dude. You are the monster, sir. I also am the monster because I also burned
That's
him.
Terrible.
The truth is out. We have all failed. There should be an achievement for that, so you can see who your friends are monsters.
Yeah, actually, the achievement should be if you don't burn them, because in games like this, it's basically a scorched earth scenario. It's like, well, obviously, if I don't turn on the fire, he's going to get out and chase me again. And yeah, I did some reading. I'm like, that is clever. That's clever that they gave you that agency here to turn on that fire or not. And I'm sure a lot of people did and very few people didn't.
I also want to throw out here, we talked last time, or I talked about the fat phobia in the first game, and I think in this game there is, you know, the one fat character, the doctor, who fatness is not a part of his character identity or anything in the way that they were saying something about like fat people eat a lot of food in the first game, mm-hmm. while still using fatness as a shorthand for disgusting in a way. So not as terrible as the first game, not that great in the grand scheme of things, but it's definitely one of those things that contributes to the character's overall design.
As a viewer of that scene and that character and the way these characters are built, I didn't see that his fatness was making him disgusting, because we also have a very thin, spindly teacher who is equally disgusting in her like serpentine neck situation that she's going on. So I definitely feel that they did a lot better with not making this about fatness and gluttony. Like there's right. that's not a gameplay plot element here at all. And I think that that changes things for me, because that was making me feel not uncomfortable, but like I felt like this would make people upset. And I don't like contributing to something that would upset somebody. And here I'm glad that they kind of like let that part of Little Nightmares go and let us play a the same kind of game without any of those elements involved.
For sure. We can criticize and love at the same time.
Yeah.
I also wanted to go back to what you said, James, about the fuses. There is a world in which this game feels like Star Wars Episode 9 fetch quest, back and forth, get the fuse. They did not do that. I thought the fuses at the beginning of this level were an amazing way to guide the player in a way that wasn't, you know, lamppost here or, you know, anything along those lines. It's just get the fuse to go to the next place. You don't have to think about it too much. It's just a clever environmental way to guide the action.
I was thinking, just as you were talking about the teacher and the long neck and stuff, and it reminded me there's like a Japanese ghost, which is, I think, the same kind of idea of a long neck. And that's what some of those things reminded me of. But yeah, I didn't like the teacher. I just...
We're all clear. No one likes the teacher.
I mean, it's like of all the baddies that you encounter. I mean, it was in the first game, it was the guy with the very long arms that I didn't like, and so clearly I have a problem with people with elongated anatomy.
The one thing I do want to say about the puzzles, which I thought was really cool, another element that they used of having this, you know, this partner that you aren't controlling, I felt like she was very involved, as opposed to in a lot of games when you have a companion, sometimes you feel either brought down by them because you're like, I have to go find them and bring them back because they're not like they're not moving with you. Like you're the babysitter, right? Or they just kind of like get in the way or they disappear. There's always like something strange about having like this, you know, NPC companion, right? But here, I loved how they played this and the way they programmed it and the way that they have her kind of having her own agency at times, and you never felt like you had to babysit her. Like she was always there to help, but also she was there to move things along. And a few times I noticed this where in the orphanage, when you have the puzzle with the bear and there's a key in one of the stuffed animals, because you see the x-ray on the wall, or maybe this was in the hospital. Maybe it was in the hospital.
It was.
So I love that when you pick up a toy to like bring somewhere, she also picked up a toy and brought it somewhere, or if like you weren't getting that, I was like busy exploring, trying to find achievements. So I was like distracted and she would like pick up a toy and like start leaving with it or go somewhere with it. And I was like, oh, the game's trying to use her to tell me like what to do because they think I'm stuck. I was not stuck. I was looking for hats, which I found. Thank you. Anyway, and there was another point where you're doing the fuses. And when you throw the fuse through the bars after like, you know, a big maze of finding the fuses, she takes it and plugs it in for you. Yeah. Like she goes and she will like bring it somewhere else, like even off screen, even multiple rooms away. She took the fuse and like brought it over to the main area. And I was like, OK, that's really cool that they put that in there, that they're showing that this other character isn't a helpless thing that you're babysitting. They're not just there to boost you up onto higher shelves. They're also like kind of playing the game with you. And they did just enough that you didn't feel like, okay, you're just solving the puzzles for me now. like just give me a second while I look for hats. But yet she was there to like move things along in a really delicate way. And then also, even if it's not moving things along, even if you weren't taking a long time, she did some stuff. And I thought that that was really cool that they built that in. And so you really felt like you had a companion and a partner here. And you really wanted to always be like, you know, do your little whisper like, hey, like, and hold her hand because you felt like you were in this together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say it did feel like a proper partnership, which of course makes her ultimate betrayal even worse.
Right, right.
This might be my favoritely developed companion in a game. It's not like you have to, you know, do puzzles to get Ellie across the water in Last of Us or something. Like, this person helps you out and mm-hmm. also moves things along without feeling like they are, you know, the assist mode in the game.
Yeah.
I also like how they're kind of her waiting screen. I love, there's like so many creepy times that she's like left behind a door because you mm-hmm. get boosted up and then you have to like go through things and then you get back and you find her. There's one point where she's like breaking the fingers on this mannequin. Yeah. It's yeah. so creepy and I love it so much. I like, you just show up into this room and she's like crouched in this dark room breaking the fingers of this plastic mannequin. And I'm like, oh girl, you're so weird. Like, but I'm really into this. Like, let's go. Let's continue going. Like, you do you. Like, this is awesome.
That's amazing. I did not catch that.
Yeah, she had a couple other ones too.
She's bad. I was just saying this. It's like, if you're paying attention, I mean, I half expected to come into a room and find her like eating gnomes and stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like the other one, right? Like, she's warming her hands by the fire as you're just like, you know, after you burn that guy. Like, there's, oh, also, you will die if you try walking into the fire, which I did try that because I wanted to see if that was an achievement. I tried everything in this game. Nothing was an achievement, by the way.
This is why it took us 10 months to make this episode.
Yeah.
Spend a full week exploring one room, then move on to the next one.
Yeah. That is kind of how I played. Actually, because I played that way, did you guys find the lady statue?
I don't think
I guess
did.
Not.
There are a lot of nods and little things. There is one point where like you can kind of, you go into a room when you're like trouncing through buildings and some of them. This is like past the hospital and it's raining outside and you're kind of roof jumping from roof to roof. There's one point where you get thrown into a room from like a swinging part or something. And you have the choice of like leaving the room and going down the fire escape. And this is where a lot of these moments, they call it the 2.5D. We talked about it in the first game, but I guess we should just mention it right now. So the gameplay, it's in 2D and you have like these puzzle platformers, but you can also go forward and back in the scene. So certain points there's depth, or certain points you're running away from something and you need to run towards the camera and then make a turn. And so it's not quite 3D. It's not quite 2D. Mm-hmm. So it's just something in the middle. And there is this moment where you can like leave the room that you just like got through and you can like go forward, or you could turn around, go back out the window, go down the fire escape, like away from yourself and then into another room of the building. And that's where like secret things are, right? You could pick up like a hat, and like there's a lady statue in there that is a big, big nod to the second game. Well, first, second game. I love finding that kind of stuff. I love the little like you know, playing to the fans and putting that kind of iconography all over the place. And it really does delight when you find it.
The camera is locked in one direction like Animal Crossing, and when you have that limited perspective, hiding things in that really creative way makes a lot more sense. And in a game where they hide as many secrets as the Little Nightmare series, I think that makes a ton of sense.
I now have this mental image of Tom Nook warming his hands against a fire, burning some residents.
He probably does. He's a creator, too.
I mean, I would say the chapter 4, which is the city, which is the bit that we were just talking about, I think that was my favorite section of the game because there's less being chased, although there is, you get chased. There's this thin man with a hat who seems to be the main antagonist I use the word seems to. But you get in that, you get the your own little supernatural ability, which is to sort of go into televisions and use them as portals and leap around. And
love I loved that.
Yeah, that was my favorite thing, all the little puzzles with that. It's like, right, I need to get a television over here because then I can use this television to leap here and I can, you know. It's, again, giving you more agency in this kind of nightmare because it's like, well, I've demonstrated that I can use weapons, but now I've actually got a power which I can use to do something. And I think there was a section in that with a little store and a shopping cart. You're trying to get the shopping cart down and things. And that was, I think that was one of my favorite little puzzle areas.
The shopping cart puzzle's a high point in the game.
Yeah. But it does end with you being chased through trains and things by this creepy guy.
I liked how the TV set weren't only like the purpose of these portals and like this new style of gameplay and travel, which I love that. I adore this. But it also added a lot of world building because now you're in this city and you have these enemies. Well, they're just kind of like people who are obsessed with the television and their faces have become sunken in. So they are these monsters that are just kind of like emaciated all over the city because like you can tell that they decided to like not eat or bathe or upkeep their city. They're just absolutely obsessed with these televisions or whatever broadcast is. And what I really love is that they took this idea of using televisions as portals. And it's not just like, oh, hey, look, there just happens to be a television just like hanging over here that you can portal through. It's part of the story because there's this one scene where you're in this woman's apartment and she's like watching the TV and you have to like portal to the outside. And there's another TV on a rope hanging outside the window. And at first you think like, oh yeah, the game placed it there so you can like get outside with the portals. But when you think about it, because you have to distract her with the screens in order to get past, the television is hanging outside of the window so that like she, the character, could watch TV instead of looking out the window. Like if you think about this, like as the world used to be before everything got really gross, like that's so cool to me that they use those elements and yet you can like use, you know, anthropologically in the game, like a way to figure out like how these people lived. And it makes sense the way everything's all set up. And that's really very cool. And I like that they added this in kind of towards the end where it wasn't just like an overused feature. It was like you got yourself all through these like spooky things. And they kind of used elements from the first game where you have like these, you know, giant adults that are kind of that are chasing you and you're going through. And then you get like the payoff of like this new cool feature. And then not only does it world build, but it also is implied of it brings the story along because you have Mono who keeps trying to interact with these televisions and like get a clear vision that of what his vision is of this doorway and this hallway. So you have all of these elements coming together with the televisions and the crumbling city. It's all just very well done and put together without having like any cutscenes or any, you know, like, oh, let's read the poster on the wall or you found a scrap of paper that describes why the world is like this. It's like it lets you figure it out and it makes you feel so cool for figuring it out. Like just like you said with the puzzles, like when you can get a puzzle right and it makes you feel good and smart that you solved it. I think that is just a wonderful way to build this creepy world without spelling it all out for you.
Yeah, I think if this was a game that had like little audio diaries that you picked up where you had like some woman talking about her favorite TV show, it would kind of just ruin all the tension. So
yeah, and that restraint, I'm really pleased that the developers and the artistic team had the restraint here to let the audience be smart about it and figure it out for themselves.
Yeah. I love the idea that restraint or technical limitations led to a lot of the narrative innovations in modern games like Gone Home, Got Away with doing so little in the world by adding in these audio diaries, and now audio diaries are freaking everywhere. Whereas in this case, it does take a sense of restraint to make a creative game like Little Nightmares or Inside or Limbo and not make it like a full 3D open world kind of thing with these same elements, because they're really distilling it down to its own unique, you know, atomic elements. My other favorite thing about the TV scenes are that the remote turns these levels into like manipulating the humans to go other places by turning off one TV and doing another. They're like magnets. They're attracted to it. And I love turning off one TV, making the human go another place, and jumping back through that TV to get outside the window. Excellent, excellent little bit of game design.
And if you're going to tell me that I had an option as to whether to electrocute that woman, I think there was a woman that you electrocuted.
Yeah, in the bathroom.
In the bathroom. Right?
Just checking, like, this isn't another one.
I tried to get away from her a few times without electrocuting her, and I'm like, well, we're doing this. Get in that watery bathroom.
Yeah.
On a personal level, The Ring is one of my favorite scary movies, and one of the things I still have nightmares about, the little girl climbing through the TV, and the chase sequence at the end of chapter 4 was perfect for me. I hated it and loved it in the same way I hated and loved the teacher, because it's just everything I love about creepy things and TV static and like somebody chasing after you, but then using supernatural TV abilities to like jump 15 feet ahead. Like, how'd you get there? A+. Great job.
Brian, can you continue to talk about kind of like the end of chapter 4 and bringing us into chapter 5?
I love that the, I'm going to call him Slenderman because, of course, Slenderman and the internet and everything. He climbs out the TV and starts to chase you. And to your point, the TV warping mechanic is brought in very late into the game, because I feel like if it were brought any earlier in the game, people would start thinking, now, hang on, how can Mono and the Slenderman person both do this weird power? Interesting. Hang a lantern on that. But this this creepy person, very nicely dressed in 1940s fashion, will chase you outside of the TV while Six is trapped inside of the TV. You see Six banging on the glass from inside of a TV at one point. And eventually you are running through these train cars that you are able to jump just out of reach of the creepy TV man, and then he's able to teleport past you. And again, one of my favorite conceits in horror is that people can do that. I forget how that sequence ends. How do we ultimately get away from Slenderman?
You have this mechanic where as you touch the television, you have to use the left stick to tune the TV, and like once you get the proper tune, it gives you some focus, and that's been happening throughout the entire game, and it gives you like a clip of this vision in the hallway and the door a little bit more each time, and eventually you get to the point where you tune to this part and you are in the memory or dream, and it like drags you through, because at this point you are trying to rescue Six, who has gotten pulled through the TV, and so you're trying to rescue her, and you get through this TV world, and then you find yourself in this alternate strange universe where you are kind of in this limbo of a vision, and you're hearing voices, and then you come to like a room where everything is floating and distorted. It gets very weird, but I'm here for it. Like, I don't feel like it didn't feel out of place, but yet I felt out of place. Does that make sense? Like, as a player, it led me to this point, and I was there for it. But as a character, I was like, what the hell? So before we get completely into the game pink world where we were, where I got stuck and started texting you guys, what the hell am I doing? I do want to mention one scene where as you're running across the rooftops and you are experiencing a lot of these TV things, there's this one scene where there are a bunch of people kind of like lined up looking at this beacon. And as you're like looking at this beacon, the people are like falling off the building. That part is so creepy and cool. And that connects to the whole idea of this beacon. And that's where like it brings you. You have kind of this standoff with the tall man. And you kind of have like, you find out that you have similar powers to them. And as you are like battling with this tall man and you have like these similar powers that you're like going back and forth, you seems like you defeat him, but it's not super clear because he kind of glitches out a lot like the TV does. And that's when you are brought to this the radio tower, the beacon building room, and you're into this like dream world.
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed the changing the laws of physics around you sort of aspect to it, and the puzzles, like the ones it was like sounds that you had to follow and things like that. And I like those kind of like observational puzzles where it's like, okay, what's different here? What am I trying to figure out? There's a big boss fight with Six, who has been turned into, you know, one of these giant monster creatures, basically. And that took me a lot of tries to get through that one, because you got to smash all these music boxes, and that she can reach her hands through the sort of doors which portal to the other side of the room. So you have to kind of like lead her one way so that you can run the other way and go in and smash her music box. Just a bit
those weird. Were weird sets of puzzles that required you to have timing and intuition for where Six would be, when you could call, when you could go through a door, when you could climb up a thing, and when you have like a split second to smash the music box before you move to the next room. Yeah. I enjoyed them, but it was a little frustrating, and I kind of wish this was a little bit more combat-y rather than twitch reflex kind of thing. Yeah. I was also stuck exactly where you were, Tiff, with the pink doors and the sounds. I had no idea sound was the solution to the puzzle. I just kept moving back and forth thinking something was broken.
Me too. That's what I was Googling, like, I thought I broke it. Yeah.
You broke your fun new toy on the Switch.
Yeah, totally. This chapter, the Signal Tower, as it's called, it's so interesting because like you're traveling through the majority of this game through this like crumbling environment. And at the end, like right before you start this chapter, the buildings kind of like also begin to crumble and like change, and like everything kind of feels like it's imploding on itself. And like that's when you're like kind of brought into this other dimensional world here that has something to do with TVs and distortion, right? Like there's a lot of distortion going on, and it's very visceral because it's kind of distorting everything. Like there's distorted gravity, there's distorted color, and it's so very beautiful. You know, when you are traveling on the steps as you go through those pink doorways, and there are moments where it's like you're like the camera has panned out and you're this tiny figure on the steps. I love when games like this do that, where they give you the vastness of the environment that you're in those moments of like panning out, and they really make you feel how tiny you are in this entire world. And especially here, I'm thinking of this one moment where everything is very pink and the light is kind of like right behind you and you're going up these steps, and it's all just, it's very beautifully eerie, and I love that visual in this game. I love that it feels like you're going through someone's like emo art project, and I'm so here for that. Like I just, games that are visual like this and give you the feelings that this game gives you, it really speaks to me as a person. And that makes me feel very heard when I'm playing this game. And it's like, I'm not a dark person, like, at all. I'm a very happy person. But, like, I like these little dark elements. And I like these, like, delightfully smart things that are involved in games like this. And I like when a game makes me feel smart. And also, I like when a game makes me stop and appreciate, like, the beauty of light, or the way, you know, the rain is moving around, or the if a game is a little bit misty or something like that. Or, like, the very first game, the first Little Nightmares, how the boat, like, subtly rocked back and forth. Like, these games are very well developed and delight people that pay attention to that kind of stuff. And I think that that's why games like this are so worth discussing, because hearing just like a title like this, you'd be like, oh yeah, it's a game, I would like to play it. But it's so much deeper than that. And I think that that's what it brings you into this final chapter just becomes it titillates all the senses here, because like now you're following sound, like you said, through the door, and then you have this battle with Six. But the battle is, it is strange that you have this large creature, like you've battled before and you're a small little person, but you have to use what you have. Like, so you whisper to like get her distracted, and you like dart through a door because you're tiny and she's big and lumbering and trying to protect this music box. And there's a lot going on here. But then as the game moves you along, it brings you into an ending that like you are just not expecting. Like, you're trying to save her from being this another long-armed monster, but you smash the music box eventually and she kind of becomes Six again, like the person that you know, and then you're running from an eyeball blob. And,
yeah. And I wrote down pulsating mass of flesh and eyeballs.
Yeah, it's just awful.
Just copy and paste it from inside.
Exactly. I mean, it's so inside. And then you like you're running across this chasm, like you're trying to like get out of here. And then when you get to that final moment, as we mentioned earlier, and you're grabbing her hand like you've done many times before, she's helped you across like extra wide chasms before, and she hesitates, and she hesitates for a while, and then she drops you. And the game keeps going. The game keeps going after that. You think like that's the end. Like that's the end. Like she's going to go forward into the next game and she drops you and you're dead in, you know, into the eyeball pit. And that's it. But yet the game keeps going. And that is crazy to me. In a good way. Crazy in a good way.
I know, I was just going to say like that we kind of get to the reveal of this thing is that after you get dropped down into the pit, you're sitting on a chair, and then you see your character basically age in various stages, and then I was like, ah, right, I know where this is going. And yes, by the end you're wearing a hat, so you are indeed it was yourself pursuing you through that previous level. And one of the things that I've seen people mention is, like, for most of the game, you're wearing, like, by default, a paper bag over your head or hats or whatever. And right at the end, you don't. I can't remember if it gets knocked off or whatever.
And it gets knocked off in the battle with the tall man when you're in the street battle. Like the Dragon Ball Z style, like.
So I think there was a speculation I saw that one of the reasons that she drops you is that she sees your face and realizes that you are indeed the person who has been tormenting her. So it could be that maybe, you know, this betrayal is more of a, wait a minute, you know, you just did all this stuff to me. I see where this is going. So could be that.
But Manu, the character, doesn't know that. And we as the player don't know that yet.
Mm-hmm. No. You know, it seems plausible that why else would you lose your face covering just before that?
I love that theory.
Oh, I love that theory, too. That's so interesting, because like throughout the game, there is a lot of indication of like these little glitchy characters that you are kind of rescuing, or like you kind of absorb like in a strange way, as they're the collectibles. And then there is this very strong element of when Six is taken inside of the television and she becomes a glitchy element. And there's even a moment where her glitch, her staticky self is guiding you through things. And you know, when you battle the tall man, he is also very glitchy in that part. You know, he looks like television static. And when you find out that it's really yourself or some sort of projection of yourself, and, you know, you've come full circle and you're stewing on the betrayal that Six dropped you, turns you into this monster that you've been running from. It's all very, very cool. And I love that they've given this game its own breathing room here. They didn't directly tie it into the other game to be like, you know, force feeding you like the story of like how this something happened from, you know, Little Nightmares 1. This is its own thing and you can just let it go. But the character Six, she's the one that moves on, and it's a nice tie-in, but it's not a necessary element. They both get to stand on their own.
I would not have guessed that after the game I just played and I saw, you know, how everything happened, all these villains, all these creepy levels, I would not have guessed that this game would have a twist ending that made me want to Google theories about the game. Hmm. Like, you think that with, you know, Inside or, you know, Journey, a lot of other games, you know, Edith Finch, Gone Home, Firewatch, all those other games are like, I want to learn more about this. I would not have guessed that this game would give me something that juicy as that twist ending to say, oh, now I want to learn this much more about this world and these games. And now I'm starting to think that Little Nightmares as a franchise could be like Fargo style, almost one story every few years of, you know, just checking back in on this world and these characters that are, you know, loosely connected, but doing their own thing in a really creative way. I think that'd be amazing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that kind of takes us to the point that Tarsia Studios got bought by Embracer Group back in December 2019. And they have said that they are not making any more Little Nightmares games, but Bandai Namco, who owns the rights, have implied that they will be making another one. So, like, with a different development team. Because there was a statement from, I think it was the studio head, and he said, "It's bittersweet to announce that we are leaving the world of Little Nightmares behind us. It'll always be dear to us at the studio. Since being acquired by the Embracer Group, it's now time for us to embark on a new chapter, create new IPs, and explore new worlds." So it will be, I think we will get a Little Nightmares 3, but I think it will be, you know, another team who's making it. So I don't want to dismiss it before I see it, but I think, you know, it was kind of, you're going to need that art style, you know, that puzzle design, all those elements that I think are going to be very hard to kind of replicate without, like, seeming you're a cover band or something doing it.
Another prequel of a prequel. So, like, yeah. Really, really removed in the beginning.
I was looking, you know, up what the developers are doing, you know, if there was any indication. And there is this other company called Section 9 Interactive that seems to have spun off with former developers of Little Nightmares 1 and 2, who've got this upcoming sort of sci-fi action horror game that certainly stylistically, like in lighting and all that kind of thing, looks very much like Little Nightmares, but is more of a, well, you've got a gun and you know, you're dealing with more sort of Alien the movie style things. Also another pulsating mass of flesh, because apparently that every game needs one. And the Limbo and Inside devs are working on this game called Somerville, which looks interesting as well. Quite a slightly different art style to it, but still, you know, that looks like that feeling of, you know, you traversing an environment and things. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with Little Nightmares going forward, because I know it's a rights issue and they got bought and all these things, but it's a shame that they are not getting to continue exactly, you know, whoever writes the third one gets to decide what happens to 6 and all this.
So I do want to mention about the scene, the extra scene that you get for collecting all of the hats. So basically what happens is you see 6 coming out of the TV, like, because now she went through a portal after dropping you into the, you know, the eyeball pit. And she is seen there. There's like a flyer on the ground in another language that you're not able to read. But for people who've played the first game, you can tell that it's an advertisement for the Maw. And then you see her, like, her stomach growls and she grabs her stomach like she's getting hungry. And it just leaves there. So it kind of like sets up that she's going to go and find this place. But that's it. Like, it is 15 seconds of like her coming out of the TV. They close up on this flyer that, if you don't know, it's just a flyer. It looks weird. And then her stomach growls and that's it.
So I think there's also, there's like her sort of shadowy self as well present there in the scene too.
Oh yeah. So, I didn't catch that.
So there's kind of like a split, you know. So I don't know what it means exactly, whether, you know, her experience of being turned into a monster turned her into a monster, if you see what I mean. Or, yeah, because she didn't seem great as a person from the start of this thing. But, no. you know, who knows?
I think we really do need a prequel, because I need to know how she got into that hunter's house, right? Like, I'm curious about that. And we thought that she was the daughter of the lady, which doesn't seem to be true either.
No.
Just a fan, apparently. I think there was like a very small DLC or something for this, which I didn't play.
I didn't play it either, because as I'm looking at the page right now is when I just found out about it. It's called The Gnome's Attic. Like,
you know what it is? A single room in the very beginning of the game, and it was not worth purchasing the extra few dollars for a reference to a gnome from the first game. Did not enjoy. It's not DLC in that way. It seemed more like a pre-order bonus cosmetic thing, but it changed the world rather than the character. Not good.
Okay, good to know.
I had looked into it as whether it was worth purchasing, because I really liked, as I said, the DLC of the first game. I thought it was better than the first game itself. But yeah, so that was all there is. And from the sounds of it, there's no more DLC coming for that. You know, they got the PS5 and Xbox Series X versions out, I think it was kind of like 3 or 4 months ago or something. And that's it.
So before we end, is there anything that anyone wants to mention or highlight or favorite moments from this game that we haven't touched on yet? Brian?
You mentioned this game really spoke to something about who you are in a way that was like, let me think about that for a second. I'm not a dark person, but in that kind of way. And that gave me a new sense of context for how I feel about this game with, you know, I love horror, I love puzzles, I love, you know, beautiful story-driven games, and I love, you know, games that take 5 hours rather than 40 hours to play. In the same way that, like, I love pop music, I love references to old games, and I love emotional experiences, Sayonara Wild Hearts, favorite game of all time. I think it's so cool when someone as competent as this studio and with the same kind of like creative vision as something that, you know, one of us would make in a game, can take this idea and turn it into something beautiful that we can all play and enjoy. With things like musicians or directors or, you know, movie directors, stuff like that, it's easy to ask them to just like shut up and play the hits and make another Kill Bill movie or another like album that's like the old stuff that you love from the 90s, but not the stuff from the 2000s, you know, things like that. Whereas for a game studio, it feels so much harder to reconcile that this team that made Little Nightmares 1 and 2 will not be making a third one, but they have their own ideas and journey they want to go on, so we're going to love and support them regardless, in the same way that, like, maybe after this Weezer album, maybe they'll go back to Pinkerton-style Weezer. Like, we don't know, but that may only take 3 years or so. Like, stuff like that can't really happen in video games in a way that the glacially slow process of making game can really support. Also, low point of the entire game was the freaking elevator puzzle where you have to jump on top of the elevator off the thing. I hated that one. Had to Google it. Yeah, that's all I have to say.
I got that one, I have to say. I think I look forward to seeing what they do next. And I do wonder if it's going to be, you know, Little Nightmares with the IP serial numbers filed off. Is it going to be that kind of same horror with weird art style, or are they going to say, well, let's do something, you know, doesn't look like a Tim Burton nightmare? Are they going to do, because I mean, I enjoy the game, and yeah, I enjoyed the darkness, if not the being chased by the darkness. But I would love to see them try something different as well, you know, using the same skills. And yeah, it sounds like if there's a whole bunch of former devs who are working on this sci-fi project, it might be that when they get bought, you know, some of the creative people have left and are going to do other things. So, you know, in a way, this is your band splitting up possibly moment, that, you know, they might still be called the Beatles or who, I don't know, trying to think of a contemporary reference to, so that I don't sound old. But you know what
Rock
I mean.
Band is better than Guitar Hero, even they sold the rights to Guitar Hero and then went off to make the second one.
Yeah. I mean, it'll be interesting to see, because I think all of us love these games, you know, like we all loved Limbo and Inside. And I think we came to this game thinking, yeah, well, it's not going to be quite as good as those, but we like it. So we like those kind of things. So let's try this one. And I think we've come away from this. I think this is its own unique thing in a lot of ways, because there's things that those other games do better in terms of controls and puzzles, I think. But this, in terms of the art design and everything, I think is really strong.
What I want to say is that I'm thankful very much for the two of you for enjoying games like this and getting to talk about it with me, because I feel like they're not little niche games. Like, they're out there. They're pretty big games. But once you discover them, you feel like you're in kind of a little, we're going to use the word creepy again, a little creepy club, because it's not for everybody and people don't discover them as easily because they look scary. And so I really enjoy that I get to talk about these cool little games with you guys, and that we get to have so much fun on a show like this and discuss, like, you know, the beauty that we can find in something that someone would be like, this creeps me out. I mean, my husband doesn't even like listening to these games because he gets scared. Like, he doesn't like them. They're not his cup of tea. And so I'm very thankful for having friends that I can talk to this about. And we are very thankful for having an audience out there to listen to us. So I would like to thank the both of you formally for joining me on this episode of The Incomparable. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you so much, Tiff. Wait, why aren't you pulling me up? Why aren't you? No!
And James, thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm happy to be in the creepy club with you all. But now I'm looking at Tiff in this different light, now that you've said that, Brian. And I'm thinking, if we were hanging on a ledge, would she just look us in the face and then drop us into a pit of flesh and eyeballs?
Well, I will end on saying I would never drop either of you into an undulating pit of eyeball blobs.